From the studios of KUSP in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. There is a sensational new book about the golden age of Hollywood, which shines a pretty harsh light on the reality of the Dream Factory, MGM. The book is called The Life and Times of Mickey Rooney, and the authors, Richard A. Lertzman and William J. Burns, are my guests this week. Gentlemen, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you.
People will figure out which one of you is which, but introduce yourself so that they'll know.
I'm Rick Lertzman.
I'm Bill Burns.
You're the famous William Burns expert on UFOs and so forth.
Yes, this is actually, yes, speaking from planet Earth.
And how did you hook up with Richard Lertzman to write this Mickey Rooney book?
Actually, we hooked up on a other book completely. We hooked up on our first book, Dr. Feelgood, when Rick was doing the biography of Robert Cummings, an incredible story in and of itself, and in speaking to Dwayne Hickman, whom I represented years ago for his book, Forever Dobie, Dwayne said, oh, you might as well talk to Bill Burns, because he was a godson of George Burns, and we all worked for him. And so when Rick and I began talking about Bob Cummings, you know, bells go off and say, wait a minute, this is the same doctor who treated JFK with methamphetamines. My God, there's this huge story. How big was Dr. Feelgood in Hollywood? And then we talked about that, and we talked about the politics and said, you know, there's a book here. And so in the course of doing that, we interviewed Mickey Rooney, because Mickey Rooney and Judy Garland were both teenage, I mean, talk about gateway drugs. When they were teenagers at MGM, they were given methamphetamine-type drugs to keep them up all throughout the day on these 10-hour shoots, or 12-hour shoots in some cases. And then at night, because they were all revved up from shooting all day, they were knocked out with barbiturates for the time they had to sleep. They were up in the mornings, shot full of drugs, and off to the studio lot. So when Mickey was telling us about his years at MGM, especially with Judy Garland being these two teenage stars, and the more the story got involved, and then Mickey died in 2014, and we said, you know, we have so much material on Mickey Rooney, you know, we know so much about him, let's talk to his children and his stepchildren, and then very quickly a book formed up.
Right, I mean, you have interviews in the book that seem to be about this subject, and yet you conducted them decades ago. So you've been working on it a long time, but not realizing it.
Right. I mean, Rick has been doing interviews with some of these people long before the book. I mean, on other subjects, because Rick was the editor of the of his own film magazine, and he'd been doing that for years, and had gone to film school, and had made a lot of connections with that.
Well, Richard Lertzman does it. Did it disturb you as a film fan when you discovered all of these sort of dark stories about MGM and the golden age of Hollywood?
You know, Gary, one thing I always found out was that you kind of separate the person from the image they are on screen. You know, it's almost like a face in the crowd where Andy Griffith played Lonesome Rhodes and people thought he was a good old Southern boy, and, you know, it's a lot more complex. So over the years, you know, when I've interviewed a lot of people, you kind of separate who they are on screen and who they really are. And Mickey was no different. Mickey on screen was a tremendous talent. I mean, for 90 years, he appeared in over 400 films. He did countless television shows. He was a Broadway star, won every award. But in person, he was not Andy Hardy that he portrayed on screen as this upper middle class son of a judge. Mickey Rooney was the son of an alcoholic burlesque comic who abandoned him when he was 4 years old, and of a mother who was a prostitute at times. So I mean, he was a very, very dark story. He left a lot of wreckage in his wake. You know, we interviewed almost all of his family and friends. We even interviewed a mistress he had for over 60 years. So, you know, you learn to separate the Mickey Rooney that everybody expects and the Mickey Rooney that he is on screen. Just, it's two different two different realms, and we try to connect, you know, which, you know, how he operated his entire life.
Yes, you wouldn't reveal in your book the identity of Mrs. Smith, as you called her, the mistress of Mickey Rooney, but you can reveal it here on this radio show because nobody listens to this show.
We had given her
a
word.
She was an actress, and for over 60 years, Mickey, and it was almost like a same time next year from that play of the same name, Mickey and this woman had a very close relationship, more so even than a sexual relationship. They had, Mickey was able to reveal who he really was. He was able to let his hair down he was able to bounce ideas and thoughts and try to get direction for his life. And she kind of gave him that for 6 years. And Bill and I were privileged to look at letters and documents over the years between the two of them. And it was just really astounding to see Mickey really reveal, which he didn't do with his own wives, but how he revealed himself to this, to Mrs. Smith over six decades.
You know, the funny thing about that, Gary, is that since most people, I would say at least 90%, probably more, model their marital and parental relationships on their own families, since Mickey had no family, there was no model for it. But in terms of Mrs. Smith, there was absolutely no familial commitment. There was no marriage. There was no, you know, you're my official mistress. We're going to meet at certain times and screw off our spouses. There was none of that. There was only a casual friendship. So Mickey felt more and more open dealing with somebody. And also, they had a long-term relationship from the 1940s until really the month he died. So you have to look at from that point of view. There was a familiarity there.
There she is now. So we were able to sustain, he was able to sustain a relationship with her because he was not married to her.
That's part of the thinking, yes.
That's true. You know, and most of Mickey's wives were kind of searched for kind of a mother figure. He may have found that in his eighth wife, Jan, who he was married to for nearly 40 years, like 38 years. And he always was in search. You know, his own parents, you know, as I said earlier, you know, were really not parents. They were just there. He was kind of a feral child. He had no direction. He never was taught a moral compass. You know, he grew up backstage at a burlesque house, and you know, he learned, you know, seeing all the strippers and everybody around back there, his own mother turning tricks. He grew up on the MGM lot, you know, went to the Little Red Schoolhouse, but on that lot, in the morning, you know, Judy Garland and Mickey Rooney were given methamphetamines, and at night they were given drugs to knock them out. So they really, you know, he had nobody really to give him any kind of guidance at all.
Well, you know, you bring up an interesting point about your book that I wanted to ask, and that is when you say that Mickey Rooney and Judy Garland were given drugs, and I have no doubt that it's true, but there are certain things that you say in the book, you present them as fact, and I'm wondering, you know, I'd never heard them before, or I've heard them, you know, hinted at, but you sort of state them. How can you be sure? For instance, you said that Wallace Beery was the murderer of Ted Healy.
Well, the story between Wallace Beery and Ted Healy is a very controversial issue. And there's different books that have been written, and so we kind of, you know, used evidence that a lot of other people have presented, with, especially with Ted Healy and Wallace Beery. Ted Healy was, of course, if everybody knows the Three Stooges, Ted Healy was the founder of the Three Stooges. It was always Ted Healy and his Stooges. And Ted Healy was one of the highest-paid vaudeville performers, highly paid at MGM, there's been many stories that Ted Healy and Wallace Beery were in a bar fight, and that really is what killed Ted Healy. A friend of mine wrote a book on Ted Healy that he doesn't believe that Wallace Beery is the person that murdered him. So what we did, we looked through a lot of MGM files. We had the access. We went to the Academy, went through all the files, all the letters. Another friend of ours named E.J. Fleming wrote a book, I can't remember the name of the book now, and it really looked at MGM, and it was called The Fixers,
The Fixers, right.
And the Fixers told the story of a lot of the stories of Beery and of MGM, of the doctor at MGM who treated Mickey Rooney. We actually saw files of the doctor that treated them with methamphetamine firsthand. We talked to Mickey Rooney firsthand, who told us the story. We did a lot of research on Judy Garland as well. And in fact, I was able to interview Judy's last husband, Mickey Dean, who told me a lot of horror stories of what Judy went through in the 30s and 40s at MGM.
We're talking with Richard Lertzman and William Burns, and they've just written this great book called The Life and Times of Mickey Rooney. But at the same time, even though you mentioned that you interviewed Mickey Rooney, he seems to be a not particularly reliable source for things about the life of Mickey Rooney.
Well, that's true, because Mickey Rooney reinvented his own history every time you spoke to him, because he had no sense of himself as a human being. He had sense of himself as an actor. He had a phenomenal presence on screen. He had a phenomenal presence on stage. And he had a real sense of who he was and where he was when the camera and the footlights were on. But off stage, he literally recreated himself for every conversation, just like he would recreate a character for the camera.
So how do you know when you're talking to him? Do you just assume that he's lying, or how do you know?
No. I mean, first of all, we interviewed so many of his friends that when a story cross-hatched, we knew that it was probably true. For example, Rick points out, he's pointed out before, that Mickey made some outrageous claims about his life, vis-a-vis Walt Disney, vis-a-vis Marilyn Monroe. Absolutely flat out not true.
Right. And since you could cross-reference the lies as well as the facts.
We could. Mickey told famous stories, not only to us, but to people like Larry King on his show. And Mickey would say, "I named Marilyn Monroe." Well, we did a lot of research. You know, Mickey never named Marilyn Monroe. He knew Marilyn Monroe. He dated Marilyn Monroe. She appeared in his movies. His manager was Marilyn Monroe's manager, so they had a good relationship, but he never named Marilyn Monroe. He also told the story for many years that while he was working at Larry Darmore Pictures, Walt Disney was working there producing his early films of Mickey Mouse, and he called him Mortimer Mouse. And Mickey had always claimed that Walt Disney, he sat in Walt Disney's lap and he looked at Mickey, and Mickey suggested he name the mouse Mickey Mouse, and Walt Disney said, "That's a great idea." And the truth is, Walt Disney, not true at all. Mickey Mouse was named after Walt, was named actually by Walt Disney's wife, Lillian. So, you know, all these stories, he didn't have to create stories. The amazing thing is, here's a man who, he started in silent films in 1926. He appeared with Colleen Moore. He was a star in silent films, in the Mickey McGuire comedies. He appeared with Wallace Beery. He appeared in one of the last films of Will Rogers. He appeared with Tom Mix. He really was around great icons. He was one of the, you know, his career was a matter of a lot of firsts. He was the first in Mickey McGuire. He was actually the first live cartoon that became a live action figure on the screen. He was the first superstar of a teenage idol. MGM didn't know how to deal with someone like Mickey, because Mickey and Judy became teen idols, and they reached a whole new audience that MGM was great at marketing, understood marketing, but they never expected to reach an audience of teens and preteens, and Andy Hardy hit that market. And another first is, Andy Hardy was really the first sitcom and really was the template for shows later on of Leave It to Beaver and Father Knows Best and Donna Reed, and really almost to this day it's they really set the template. So, you know, it was an amazing career, but we wanted to look at the historical aspect. We wanted to tell Mickey's life in truth instead of the fable that he had created over the years.
Well, Mickey Rooney was a very great actor, really talented performer, enormously successful in his craft, and a complete failure in absolutely everything else. I mean, he's certainly business and human interactions.
That's true, because he really never had a character. He had various characters he would play, and he could conjure up what he needed to before the camera and on stage. But in real life, there was nothing there. He never developed as an adult. And so that's why he was a failure in his marriages. He was a failure in 8 marriages, even though he died being married to Jan. They'd separated. So he failed in 8 marriages. In one respect, he failed to his children. We could tell you some horror stories about that. And he failed in business. Here's a guy who started so many companies, Mickey's Macaroni, Mickey's Square Hot Dogs, Mickey's Puppy Pop soft drink for dogs. I mean, he started all these businesses and failed and failed. And even Donald Trump, who says he'll make us all rich, tried to make Mickey hold on to his money better and failed at that.
It's really a sad story, and I guess he was kind of taken advantage of by a really talented con man.
By a number of them.
No one could tell Mickey what to do. When we interviewed Donald Trump a couple times, I said, why did you just help Mickey? He's your friend. And he would go give Mickey advice, and it would go, Mickey would just listen to the advice and do what he wanted. Terry Allen Kramer, who is one of the great producers of Broadway, and she produces Kinky Boots to this day. She produced Sugar Baby starring Mickey Rooney, and her father was Charles Allen, one of the great financial advisors of Allen & Company, a multi-billionaire. And she had Mickey sit down. Mickey was making every week $75,000 a week on Broadway, which was an amazing amount in the 70s and 80s. And she said, Mickey, sit down with my father, set yourself up, and you'll never have to work again. So Charles Allen set up an account for mutuals with Mickey and said, you know, you can live off the interest, you can live off the yields, but never touch the principal. Mickey would go into the account and go into these crazy business, Mickey Rooney's hot dogs and Mickey Rooney's macaroonies and all these insane businesses. And he started dipping into the capital, and Charles Allen said, Mickey, you know, I set you up. You're going to be set for life. And Mickey said, I'll do what I want, and that was it. You know, he just never took the advice of some really earnest and great minds, financial minds, that had offered to help him, and he just eschewed all the advice.
And all those marriages, you know, when I was reading your book, I was thinking, especially the marriage to Ava Gardner, you know, they were both young and beautiful, and if they had just kind of spent time together, and, you know, if he had just devoted himself to her, maybe we would have not seen Ava Gardner as a great movie star, but they might have had a wonderful, happy life together.
Well, that's if you can understand that Mickey was incapable of devotion. I mean, we're talking about somebody, it's like you're saying to somebody, I need you to run the mile, but really you were born without legs. I mean, that's what you're dealing with. Mickey, it's not just that Mickey didn't want to, or Mickey was mentally ill. I mean, he was, but that wasn't really the issue. It was, imagine growing up with absolutely no model for anything. It's like, you know, Rick and I have joked about he was a feral child, except there weren't wolves that he was raised by. He was raised by a burlesque cast. That's really what it was. He had absolutely no model for being married, no model for being a parent. I mean, he was married to Ava. The next day, he's on the golf course. Yeah. They're in the middle of a tour for an Andy Hardy movie, so they not really have all that honeymoon alone time. Then they get back to Hollywood. Mickey is absolutely back up to his old game, hitting all the nightclubs at night, buying drinks for everybody, playing with the band, sitting with another starlet. Ava finds out that he's sleeping with a 15-year-old in her own bed. She finds it out from Peter Lawford. So Mickey had absolutely no intention of being married except in name only, and he didn't know what devotion was. He just couldn't figure it out.
Yeah, it's pretty sad, really. Yeah, as I was reading The Life and Times of Mickey Rooney by Richard Lertzman and William Burns, I watched a few of his films and his TV appearances. I watched him on The Fugitive and on The Judy Garland Show and on The Twilight Zone. And he was a major small screen talent. I mean, not every movie star is well suited for television, but he really was. He should have been huge on TV, like Gleason or Dean Martin. Why wasn't he?
He started out in the 1950s in the Mickey Rooney Show, and you know, part of being on television in the 50s is you have to cater to the sponsors. The sponsors controlled everything, and the ad agencies controlled everything on television. So Mickey kind of, when he was taken up to Minnesota to meet the Pillsbury family, he went into a rage on the Pillsburys, and they canceled the series. Even though it was doing fairly well, he kind of had himself blackballed by the ad agencies. So by the 1960s, he's only hired by people that were friends. So in the Twilight Zone, Rod certainly had done a lot of projects with Mickey, including the comic and Requiem for a Heavyweight. And he personally, in the Twilight Zone, the last night of the jockey, he wrote that episode with Mickey in mind, as they were both kind of very diminutive, and so he wrote a story that he saw himself and he saw Mickey playing it. When you watch Mickey on television, even you know later in Bill, where he won the Emmy Award, Mickey had a great talent to play like almost every type of part. He had a range that was, you know, later on he got kind of typecast as being an elderly curmudgeon, but he had far more talent. And when you watch the range of shows that he did everything from combat. He did Gunsmoke. He did every kind of different type of show. Even in 1968, he did a pilot film called The Return of the Tornado, of the Yellow Tornado.
The Yellow Tornado, yeah.
He was a superhero. And with Eddie Mayhoff, they played two superheroes, which was a takeoff on Batman and all the series. And it was, you know, he had a great sense of comedy. He also had a great sense of drama, and he could really, because of his training early in burlesque, where he was able to do everything on stage and learn how to sing and dance, he was able to really do variety. He was able to do drama and comedy. He was able to sing. He was able to dance. When I saw him many years later in Sugar Babies at 60 years old, I was dazzled by his talent to sing and dance and perform. It's just his range was absolutely amazing.
I saw him on the street once and shook hands with him, and now I feel guilty because he probably hated me. He didn't want to be bothered by people.
No, he didn't. That was his way. He just wanted to be left alone. I mean, that was one of the problems of Mickey Rooney. He just wanted to be left alone.
Well, you can't be a movie star and be left alone, I don't think.
Well, that's what his stepson, his wife, people who knew him tried to explain to him, that you really can't be a movie star and be all alone. But in reality, and here's what I think, as Mickey got older and older, and he saw himself getting less and less relevant, sure, he was on television, he was able to pull off certain things on television and pull off certain roles. He was magnificent in certain roles, like Requiem for a Heavyweight. Nevertheless, given where he was in the late 1930s, very early 1940s, given that at that juncture of that decade, Mickey was the top star in the world. When you're the top star in the world, and you know you are, and you know you're keeping the studio alive, to be kind of marginalized as irrelevant, discarded, laughed at because of eight marriages, you're no longer the young kid Andy Hardy, you're now an old man, and you know it makes you bitter.
One of the great writers that I really respect and I know him, his name is Joseph McBride, and he wrote a great book on Frank Capra called The Catastrophe of Success. And it tells how someone at an early age becomes a superstar, and they reach the highest of all heights in show business. And like Frank Capra, he made these great films, and then for the last 40 years of his life, he didn't do anything. He was, you know, he did nothing at all. And because what he tried to do is repeat and repeat what was successful in the beginning of his career. And the same with Mickey. He tried to become Andy Hardy and tried to carry that on through a lot of his career. And you know, it was kind of the catastrophe of success with Mickey that he was great early in his career, but he had to change and adapt, and at times he did throughout his career.
Well, it really is an amazing life. And you think about all of the things that Mickey Rooney could do. He could dance. He could sing. He played, when he played piano, how many instruments did he play?
I think he played like 17 instruments. I was able to interview Sid Miller, who was a friend of Mickey's. He was in Boys Town with him, and he was also later a television director. And Sid Miller said he would go all night on a bandstand, and he can outdrum the drummer. He can play the piano, and he played it by ear. He wasn't trained. He could play a sax. He could play a trumpet. He could go on the cello. I mean, he said you've never seen. And he was just a dynamo, and he had an innate talent for music and a great musical ear.
And especially when he was young, he was very handsome.
Oh, yeah, he was a heartthrob. That's what kept bringing the teenage audiences back to Andy Hardy. That's why when he announced to Louis Mayer that he wanted to marry Ava Gardner, Louis Mayer's first reaction was shock. I mean, shock after the fact that Mickey was going wild sexually on the lot and didn't want that news to get out. But it was shock because he was saying, you're the eligible bachelor for a whole country of teenage girls, and now you're going to get hooked up. You're going to get married. You're going to take yourself out of circulation. I can't have that. So Mickey was a teen heartthrob. He was the forerunner of all the teen heartthrobs that came after him.
Ellie had a long life, and you really bring it to life on the page. The book is called The Life and Times of Mickey Rooney, and the author's my guests, Richard A. Lertzman and William J. Burns. Thank you, gentlemen, for spending some time with us on From the Bookshelf.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Well, that's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the show. We'll come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can like us on Facebook, and you can subscribe to our podcast at iTunes. I want to thank my guests, Richard A. Lertzman and William J. Burns. Their new book is called The Life and Times of Mickey Rooney. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas. I'm Gary Shapiro. See you next time.